Remember the first time you saw a race car on an open trailer? Maybe it was full of dirt, tire marks, and other battle scars. You wondered where it had been, and more importantly, where it was going next. Every open trailer has a story, and we're here to tell it. Welcome to the Open Trailer Podcast. Well, hello there. It's season number 3 of Open Trailer Podcast. Welcome to it. I'm your host, Andy Austin, and thank you so much for sticking with me for season number 3. Long gap between seasons 2 and 3, but you know this. And as I said in the mini episode, which dropped a few weeks back, this is not happening without your support, your constant encouragement of, hey, got any more of them podcasts? You gonna drop a few of them anytime soon? You know, and it's funny. I mean, you expect that, I guess, from racing people. But I would be in places that have nothing to do with racing. It's cool to have grown this to the level that it has. As I mentioned in the mini episode, a lot of life happened, but that's been covered. If you want to go back and listen to that, certainly encourage you to do so. But today we're here to talk about Dave Cudemarsh. And Dave will kick off season number 3. Season 3 will involve a number of household names as far as main racing goes. People who aren't household names but have a major contribution to racing here in this state, and a few current stars as well. Now, Dave was the owner, and still is the owner, of the iconic number 61. The orange 61 that I think a lot of people thought was a takeoff on Richie Evans. But no, not the case. And throughout this this series of episodes, Dave does drop a few truth bombs. Before we get to any of the racing, though, I like to explore where they come from, what got them to the racetrack, and the humble beginnings. Dave was a dairy farmer, never milked a cow, but we'll get into that. And some other cool stuff, too. So, again, appreciate your support, whether it was the encouragement or through Patreon, too. You know, there's certainly a responsibility when someone puts down their hard-earned cash to support what they enjoy. You know, there are a lot of different organizations that you could contribute to, and the fact that you still contribute to this one is it's quite humbling. So thank you for that. If you'd like to contribute to Patreon, it's patreon.com/opentrailerpodcast. You can do a one-time donation, or you can do recurring, whatever you feel in your heart that is worthy of what we have to offer today, which is a real treat. You know, someone who grew up in Beech Ridge watching the Orange 61 and having the, you know, being a kid from Sanford and having the Sanford connection of Bobby Turner driving that car at one point at a pretty crucial age for when I was really starting to enjoy racing. This was definitely a treat. Dave's an awesome guy, and can't wait to unpack some of this stuff. So let's get into it. It is Dave Cudemarsh, stage number 1 on Open Trailer Podcast. Enjoy. Anybody who's been around Beech Ridge, you know, knows the Orange 61. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast today, Mr. Dave Cudemarsh.
It's an honor to be here.
Where does your story begin? Where do you come from?
Well, I came from the Auburn-Lewiston area, lived in Auburn. My dad used to take me up to the half-mile dirt track back in the 50s at Oxford, you know what I mean? And Phil Libby was racing there in an A-class car occasionally, but, you know, there was guys like Curly Blair and Dickie Mooney, I remember, in the six-cylinder bombers that raced up there.
Wow.
Told me the first time they ever took me up there, I sat backwards in the grandstands because I was scared of the cars and the noise. But
really?
I turned around shortly thereafter, apparently.
What is your first memory?
Of just a kid watching the races?
Yeah.
I remember Kent, that used to do your job at Beech Ridge there, Don Kent, and he'd be playing Little Deuce, you know, She's My Little Deuce Coupe, You Don't Know What I Got. And of course, it just was part of why I became such a fan of Ralph Cusack's.
Hmm. So for those that weren't around back then, before Ralph piloted the iconic 61, he was running the Blue Deuce. And he was such a winning driver. So was it a situation where every time he won a race, they would play Beach Boys' Little Deuce Coupe?
It got played a lot. No question about it. And I was so impressed one night. Roger Shaw was leading the feature in the 49, and him and Ralph got together over in the 3 and the 4 turn, and Ralph ended up winning the feature.
Hmm.
And Ralph says, I didn't win this. I want to give it back to Roger. And Roger was such a gentleman, he wouldn't accept it. You know, but it was pretty impressive that he would give a feature back.
So you remember, you remember being at Oxford during the Half Mile Dirt days, growing up in Lewiston, Auburn. Scarborough's, but you know, a good 45 minutes south. Do you remember your first time at Beechridge or why you guys started going there?
My father was real good friends with Charlie Morris, Bob Morris's father.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie went to the races all over the place, and they followed each other a little bit, I think, back then, as I remember it. And I think they probably dragged us down there first.
Yeah. Who were some of your heroes? Who was the first driver that you were like, that's the guy?
It was probably Ralph.
Hmm?
You know, to think that he ever came and drove my car afterwards was like, how'd that happen, you know?
Right. Well, how did that happen?
I had cars at Oxford. I started in 64 with my own cars at Oxford, you know, and I drove for like a couple of years there. And then I had an obligation to the service, you know, that I had to do. And so I got into the Air National Guard in Bangor. I also started the garage business, you know, when I came back out of the service.
What was your service? What were your choices?
The draft was in effect. And so I was very lucky to get into the main Air National Guard, you know.
I did
all my 6 years at Dow Air Force Base in Bangor, made a lot of trips back and forth to Bangor.
Right.
And had the 15 days in the summer camp. But that also meant I missed one race meet a month, you know. It was just too far to go from Bangor down on a Saturday night
and make it
to Beechridge. Or,
wow.
At that time, it was actually Oxford. I was at Oxford through the 1970 season.
You talk about your driving days, which I don't think a lot of people know about. Do you remember your first race?
No. I wasn't very good at it, and the cars weren't very good. It was more for the fun of it, you know what I mean?
Right.
I remember how it ended. The last time I drove, I broke a right rear wheel off going into one turn and rolled over, and Dick Glines hit me while I was bottom side up and somebody else.
Wow.
It wasn't Dick's fault. I was in the way, obviously.
Right.
And that was kind of the end of it right there. And then George Coolidge drove for me in 68, 69, and 70.
When you say it was the end of it, was it the end of it because you got hurt or you realized that driving wasn't for you?
I think I really realized that, you know, there were people who were going to be better at that, and I was a better mechanic than some of those guys were, so it was probably the thing to do.
So, you know, we're right around your high school years. You know, you're getting ready to graduate. You're building these race cars. You're also starting your own business. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I actually went into the wrecker business in 1964 also. I was able to buy a wrecker off of Bob Greeley. Bob had gotten burned down to a Rundle Speedway in a A-class car. And
what happened there?
The fuel line broke. He had three twos on that car, three two-barrel carburetors, and the fuel line broke. And I think all he had was a screen for a windshield, and it soaked him with gas.
Wow.
And he got burned really severely. And he had a garage business there in Auburn. And
yeah, still
the
there today.
The wrecker became for sale. And I actually bought it off his wife because Bob was laying in bed. They had a trailer home there they lived in at the time out front. And I told him years later that I'd bought his old Dodge wrecker, and he says, oh, you was the one who bought it? And so he says, yeah, thanks for putting me in business up here. And so I was in competition a little bit with him then in Auburn, you know, in the same town.
So how old are you when all this is happening? 17?
Yeah, about, 19, I guess.
64?
Yeah.
So you're 17 years old. You're starting your business. How did the wrecker business go for you?
Very well. I missed 32 days of my senior year, which wasn't too good.
Did you graduate?
I did graduate.
Okay.
Yeah, they said they would have given me the automotive award, you know, in there for the top student in auto shop, but I didn't come often enough. So, but I was working all the time, and I had that rolling pretty good. And I actually got the business of the Chevrolet garage there, towing for them, Marquardt Chevrolet in Auburn.
How long does that go for? Because you're not primarily known as a tow guy.
No. So in January of 1967, after I came back from my active duty with the Air Force there, I was able to purchase Smith Garage in Auburn, with a partner. His name was Don Bailey. And the gentleman owned it, Sherwood Smith, held half the paper, and then Don and I come up with the rest of the money to buy that. And
so how much money is this, if you don't mind me asking?
It was like $10,000 each.
Right. So you're fresh out of the service, still in your early 20s. The equivalent of $10,000 in today's money is probably, what, 80 grand, you think?
90 probably. Grand? Probably.
That's a big nut when you're that age.
It was.
You bet on yourself.
Yeah, we did, and him and I, unfortunately, had the same work theory. You know, we just figured if you worked as long as you could every day, you know, everything would be all right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people are wrecking cars left and right, so. Yeah.
You know, and then after we were there for like 4 years in downtown Auburn, perfect situation, did the work for the post office. It was right next door to us. R.A. Mitchell, the big parts company, it was right next door, so you just got your parts next door. And along comes Urban Renewal in Auburn.
What was Urban Renewal?
The whole downtown area in Auburn got demolished. Every building.
By who?
The federal government.
Government came in and just demolished towns?
They, believe it or not, that post office was beautiful. They had granite steps going in and everything. They demolished the post office in downtown Auburn.
Is Urban Renewal the same thing, just to jump topics a little bit, that got rid of the train station in Portland? Maybe it is. I know that I think Urban Renewal got rid of an entire neighborhood, which became Franklin Arterial.
Could be.
Wow. So they would just come in and just wipe out the town.
And my partner and I, you know, thought that we could rebuild a new garage because it was an old wooden building we were in. It wasn't that great.
But you guys owned the building?
Yeah.
And the government just came in and took it?
Yeah. They buy eminent domain. And
can they still do that?
I don't know. The people out in back of me was Advance Auto Sales, and right. They fought them. And Darlin Auto was on the next street over. They fought them. And R.A. Mitchell, who owned they had a three-story building there with automotive parts in it, the machine shop down. They fought them, and they all lost. And I says, well, we got no money to fund them. But it did make us eligible for an SBA loan.
So wait a minute. They demolished your business, the building that you own, and said you're eligible for a loan?
Yes.
That doesn't make any sense.
And after they demolished my building, it was about 4 years before they ever built anything there. It sat vacant.
Wow. How did it make you feel?
Broke.
Yeah.
No, it was a really a strange feeling watching the bulldozer drive through that
place. Wait a minute. There was a bulldozer that you watched go through your building?
I watched it be demolished.
Who paid for that?
They did.
Wow.
They took everything. It was...
Wow.
So we had to find a piece of property as close to town as we could afford.
That seems weird.
It was weird to us.
Just sat there for 4 years. What did you guys do next?
We built a new building up on right off in Center Street in Auburn. New 60 by 80 building.
With that loan?
Yep, with that loan. And but the customers didn't. We had a great customer base downtown because they'd leave their cars in the morning where they needed it. We had a wheel alignment or regular service, whatever you wanted there. And we had more work than we could do. We usually had five people and Dawn and I, five mechanics and Dawn and I. So they didn't follow us. So we had to do something. So there was a lot of demand for people working on trucks. So I says, well, we decided to swing over to heavy-duty trucks. And, of course, we had to get all new equipment to work on. I mean, you got to have wheel dollies to pull big wheels off. It's Jeez. Just a whole different deal. And we had to learn to really work on them, you know. I mean,
right.
Which took a while.
So you started a business when you were 17, 18 years old. It thrives. The government basically says you got to move. And then your customer base doesn't follow you because it's not convenient for them. And then you have to go and learn basically a new version of the same trade and buy new tools.
Yeah, we had to reinvent ourselves, really, is what we did.
How old are you at this point?
Well, I must have been 22 or something. I was in my early 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the one part I missed there, I guess I should add in, is I bought that business in January of 67, and Sandy and I got married in June of 67, mm-hmm. You know, and she was still going to college at Gorham State Teachers College when we got married. So she was traveling back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Was the turnpike in by then?
She went the back road down there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, still, I mean, just to kind of paint the picture, I mean, this is not 1989 when this is happening.
And then, of course, the next unplanned thing that came along in August of 1968, 13 months later, our first daughter was born between Sandy's junior and senior year at college. So that was another challenge.
So the whole business thing, the young family, you know, that's a lot of pressure for someone under really any age. But, if, you know, you can't even rent a car yet. You're not even 25 years old. And all these things are happening. Are you still driving race cars at this point?
I'm still building race cars. It should have stopped then for a while.
Logic. But, yeah.
And up to Oxford at that point was when it was all one class up there. There'd be like 80, 90 cars there, you know. And they'd run four heat races and two consies, you know what I mean? So if you just qualified for the feature, the average guy, you know what I mean? It was right. It was good. And every year we were gaining. George Coolidge drove for me then. He worked for the post office next door, and he talked me into, well, I'm right here, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Build a car. And our last year at Oxford, we actually did finish third in points. We were starting to get our act together. I was beginning to wonder if it was just something I wasn't understanding. It was something I was missing. Because
who was there anybody that came up to you and helped you?
You know, the people that really ran well back then, they were some of the best kept secrets there was. You know what I mean? There was just so much experimenting going on. Mm-hmm. Now, there may have been information out there somewhere and I didn't ask for it, but, you know, I learned a lot on those cars about, you know, all the different geometries and everything else. And, you know, I worked as a mechanic all the time, so I knew the basic.
Is this when Oxford was a third mile, 3/8 mile, whichever way you want to measure it?
It was paved. We were there since Bob Baer bought it in 64. The first year he operated, I believe, was 64, or at least it was with that division.
What's the secret to getting around Oxford?
You know, that place is a lot like Beechridge. It's kind of just a big circle, you know. It's a momentum track, and you really don't need a lot of horsepower, but you got to really, really handle.
Yeah. Did you ever win?
I think George won in that last year that we finished third in points. I'm pretty sure of that. I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure of that.
Hmm.
And then I decided I always loved the modified, so in that, after the 1970 season ended, I built a 37 Chevy modified and got wrecked one night down the backstretch bad. And I just kind of set that car aside. But again, I could have stopped right there. Mm-hmm. So, but I started looking around, well, what can we do to finish the season? Not that we were up in points or anything. It would have been just a good time to stop and regroup for next year. But right. Phil Libby had a coach modified that he had brought up from like...
What's a coach?
It was a 36 Chevy coach body modified. Actually, Leo Clary drove it, oh. I believe, at Norwood Arena and other places. And so I bought that car from Phil Libby.
Mm-hmm. So why don't you drive? Is there... I mean, well, not anymore, obviously. But like, so why at this point have you committed to just being an owner? Was it the new family? Was it added responsibility?
I had so many things going on. There was just too much financial stuff going on. I couldn't afford to get hurt.
Mm.
Although I was the only one that ever got hurt around my car. I was when I worked on it at different times. I got hurt. Wow. None of my drivers got hurt that I can remember. But Dick Walsenhume filled in for me after that. He actually drove the coach the rest of that year.
Oh.
In 1971.
Wow. So things start to take off for you. I thought there was a contingent from one of your loaners that you couldn't drive anymore.
Yep, my uncle, Dr. John James, I'll give him full credit, up there in Auburn.
Yeah.
I went to him when we bought the garage, and I asked him about co-signing me for a loan at Casco Bank. Because Sherwood Smith held half the note on mm-hmm. the place, and then I got $5,000 more from Casco Bank, and he did co-sign for me. He didn't give me any money, but he co-signed for me. But he made me promise that I wouldn't drive race cars anymore. But I didn't promise I wasn't going to build any of them and take care of them and such.
Yeah, no, I love the gray area because, I mean, that, you know, that's paramount in being, you know, a successful crew member, owner, driver, anybody associated with racing. We spent a lot of time talking about how much racing's a big part of your life. Was there any other sport that you were gravitating towards, something that drew your interest when you grew up?
Never.
Really?
I loved cars. Growing up next to my grandparents' dairy farm there in Auburn, I was amazed how they fixed everything. I mean, they never left that farm, and they fixed everything they had there. And I just enjoyed that. And you know, any time I'd be hanging around the farm and not doing anything, they'd say to me, you know, what I was thinking of, I wasn't, you know, about to do something stupid or anything. They says, there's a lot of work needs to be done around here, and they'd give me a job, you know, some little job.
Did you ever milk a cow?
Actually, I didn't. They never let me do that.
What?
And they were never automated. My grandfather and his brother Harry hand milked about, I don't know, 50 or 60 cows morning and night.
I always wonder how people discover, like how farmers discover that they can grow crops or humans can consume them. Like, who looked at a cow and said, you know what? We can get cheese, we can get milk, we can get yogurt, we can get all these dairy products from this cow. How do we get it? I don't know, just squeeze the tip. And sure enough, an industry was born. Like, who was the first guy to go, you know what? Look what I just figured out. No, dead serious. I've always wondered that. So you never milk a cow.
No,
you grew up on a farm.
I knew how to run a shovel and a broom.
Tell me about your 1972 season.
Okay, that was the first year that Ralph drove for me.
How'd you guys make that happen?
I met Ralph on a business, through business. You know, Ralph sold used construction equipment, used trucks, trailers, and all kinds of stuff. And so he had some stuff that we had bought off him. Some of my customers bought some stuff off him. So we got talking and stuff. And Ralph, you know, had taken, I think he might have stopped in 66 maybe, driving for D'Amico, to take time off for his business. And he wanted to come back and start driving again. And he knew I had that coach. So he said, well, then I says, well, you know, it's going to be tough because I'm still got this service commitment until the June of 72 and stuff. And but that was the first year it was that he drove for me. And it went all right. And then he left me after that, the end of that year, and drove for Frankie Moses for 1 year. But he told me, you know, I'd see him here and there. He says, Dave, if you can get something, we need something a little better, you know. He says, I'd like to come back with you, because Frankie was more on the end of his career, and I was kind of just the new guy in the block coming in, and he knew I was really interested and that he was my hero.
Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, how does that – do you remember the first time that you met him after having watched him in the stands with that Blue Deuce and hearing the song?
I'm not sure I ever met him on the racetrack or anything after that. I didn't really know him. No, it was through business.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, as I remember it. And he was just, you know, from the start of it, he was so easy to, we just always got along.
Yeah, I mean, you seem like like-minded characters, having known both of you. Pretty mild-mannered, very meticulous, and also direct, you know. So I can see how you guys would gravitate towards each other. And him being honest and saying, you know what, I love driving for you, this is great, but I need something better if I'm going to be able to, perform to the best of my ability. How much did he drive you to get better equipment and become, the car owner that you became?
He was the sole reason Dave Kudemash ever won a championship. You know, I remember him after he'd driven for a while for me, and, you know, they'd say, like, That's something I gotta say. After the races, there was not much conversation with Ralph about how things went, because he was just so easy going and this and that. He used to call me every Wednesday. He knew we worked on the car Tuesday and Thursday nights. Mm-hmm. He'd call me on a Wednesday and tell me what he thought we ought to do, this and that. And then during one of those Wednesday conversations, he said, you know, Dave, if you're going to go through all the work or working on that all week and hauling it down here, you might as well get it going fast enough so we can win some races.
You know, so he was locked tight with you.
Yeah, he really wasn't. And he just motivated me. I didn't do anything for the guy, you know. I got Ralph Cusack in my car. How'd this happen, you know, because I wasn't any big name at that point.
Yeah, so what was the number of the race car?
Well, when I was at EPTU Oxford, our race car number was 6.
And why was that?
And the first year, because when those numbers were first passed out, we went up to the Norway Legion Hall, as I remember it, and standing in line there, and Ralph Spencer got number 5 first at Oxford. He was the first one to have it before Mike Rowe, okay? Mm-hmm. And so Dave got 6, and a guy named Carol Francis got 7, and so they were assigned to
us. But who showed up first? Like, basically, if I'm the first guy in the door, I'm going to be number 1.
Yeah, and there was other people that picked up in farther in line a particular number they want. They could have picked it out, but I didn't care what number it was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So from 64 through 70, while I was up to Oxford, it was number 6. And then we came to Beechridge, my coupe that I had built, that 37 Chevy coupe had 6 on it. And the next year when I came back, it's because we missed some races, I think, in 72 because of, you know, my service commitment. Somebody else had gotten the 6 number. And so they said, what do you want? And I says, well, let's see. What could I do here? Didn't know who Richie Evans was. A lot of people think, because I had orange and I ended up 61. I had no idea at that point who Richie Evans was. Well, my garage is at 61 Turner Street in Auburn, the original one. I says, how about 61?
No kidding. Because I got a picture of you with the 6 coupe.
That's Dick Walsenhum right there.
Dick Walsenhum winning a race in 1971. What kind of guy? Tell me a Dickie Walsenhum story.
Oh, we got lots of them. My wife loved Dick Walsenhum. Because he was just so much fun. And you got to know, my wife is Jerry Major's sister. Mm-hmm. So she's, you know. Yeah. She likes to have
fun. If you want to know anything about Jerry Major and you don't know who he's talking about, he is in season 2. Go back and listen to those episodes. They're quite endearing.
So Dick Walsenhum, he always called me Coot, you know. And unfortunately, the engine that I'd built that year in that car, it overheated quite a bit because it had a lot of compression. I hadn't quite figured out the ratio there of how much compression you could have, because there was no rule, no compression rule. There was just a cubic inch limit and stuff. But actually, the best story is between her and Dick Walsenhum later. And Dick won the Super Modified feature one night in Dick LeGros Super, and my wife had brought him a chocolate cream pie, you know, because she liked him so much, you know, all covered in cream and everything. Yep. And she goes down on the track to present it with him. And for some reason, they let her down there in the winner's circle, you know. And Dick says, you don't dare throw that at me. And she plowed it right into his face.
Yeah. So, Sandy, your wife, a competitor in her own right, too. They would race the Powder Puff division. But there was also a rule back in the day at Beechridge where women weren't allowed in the pits. Matter of fact, there's an infamous sign that says so in not so many words. How did she end up driving the car? How would any of the women end up driving if they weren't allowed in the pits?
They used to come over. It was the last race of the night, and they'd come over with pickup trucks. You know, Calvin, that was during Calvin Reynolds' time, right. You know.
So they weren't allowed in the pits, but they were trucked over?
They were trucked over, correct.
Wow. Like the bunny bus?
I think that was even before the bunny bus.
No, it was long before the bunny bus, but yeah. I mean, I'm just trying to like make a connection to be like, okay, so if you have a ticket number, you're getting in the bus, and then you're going to the pits.
Then you're going to the pits. And there was full fields of cars in that Powder Puff. It was very popular for them girls. So I had built her a 66 Chevelle, and I left the automatic transmission. I only had a Power Glide transmission. It had 283 with a Power Glide in it. And I says, and I told her why. I says, I've watched the Powder Puffs before this, and what ends up happening, they don't give those girls any practice. A lot of them, I don't think, know how to drive a standard shift.
Were they set up to fail, do you think, or be a sideshow?
I don't know.
It seems that if they want that division to, like, for example, when, you know, we ended up having the Ladies League in Thursday Thunder, just speaking for Beach Ridge and other female, led divisions, you know, they got equal time with practice and all of that. But to just send them out there with no practice in a vehicle where they didn't really know what was going on, that almost seems like it's sideshowish.
Well, a lot of it. What I told my wife, I says, I've watched this, and what happens down there, some of those girls don't know how to shift or drive, you know, or whatever, but they kind of tuck the bottom, even though there was, say, 30 of them out there, right? And I says, you got to cross the start-finish line, you know, to take the green. You can't pass by that. I says, just pull it three wide. Just go on the outside with that thing. And when it was dirt, there was a line up top there that Ralph always ran through, one and two. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I said, as long as you got to be beside them going down the backstretch, you got to get right square beside somebody so they know you're out there and stuff. But those cars would all be down below her running into each other, you know, and this and that.
Right, because the
and
logic
she'd
is,
go all the way to the front, running three wide most of the time.
Where would she start in the field?
Last.
Oh, because she had won.
Yeah.
How many cars is she racing?
About 30, 32. I don't know how many they started. It was a full field of cars.
Do they have a point championship?
Yeah, she won in 1979.
So do you count that as one of your championships?
No, I never counted that.
So you could be an 11-time track champion or car owner champion.
I never tried.
Let's think about it, right?
Yeah,
she was out there and she made the laps and she got the wins and you own the car. I'd call you a 10-time.
And she wanted to make a comeback for a few races, you know. So she talked Scott Melkern into letting her run his car one night.
That's all you got to tell me.
And she won with that.
Yeah.
And the next time she was supposed to drive Scott's car again, but it got banged up or it broke down. She was so disappointed. She went over and I'm sure nobody else probably could have got that car to drive, but talked to Ralph about driving the ride car. You know, that Chummy Brown took care of.
Oh, yeah.
So Chummy Brown was her crew chief one night. And she came from the back with that ride car on the
beach. Ride of your life car.
Yeah, the two seater.
For those that aren't familiar, can you describe the ride of your life car?
I think it was like a 68 or 69 Chevelle, but it had two seats in it. There was a winner in the grandstands, a ticket number that won the ride in that car. And if you remember, Ralph rolled that over one night with Chummy Brown's daughter in it up the backstretch.
Oh boy, welcome to racing. Well, that's awesome. Do you remember your first win with Ralph?
Actually, Ralph and I won two in 72. Towards the end of the season in 72, we won two. So I think he saw the potential was there, but that car was old. And
so between you and the D'Amico years, Ralph has 12 championships and will go down in history as the most decorated driver at Beech Ridge history. Second in line, Dick Walson-Hume with 10 track championships, also a person who drove for you. Why did you guys go in separate directions?
Walson-Hume?
Yeah, you and Dickie.
Dickie was so sought after back then. He used to get paid 40% to drive.
What was the split, the traditional split?
I think it was 60-40.
Okay.
Yeah. No, other than that, I had no problem with him. He was one of the guys. I mean, the big guys.
So he just got a better deal, basically.
I got a better deal. And actually, then in 73, Phil drove for me while Ralph was over with Frankie Moses. Phil Libby drove that year.
Yeah.
And he drove the old coach. And Phil was, he just, you know, could drive anything. You know what I mean? There was one night he hit the backstretch in the heat race and bent the front. He had straight front axle in, you know, and brought it in. And I got the wishbone straightened out so the axle was up in position and stuff. But I reached in there and tried to turn the steering wheel, and the steering wheel would go tight and then loose. I says, the kingpin's bent in that, Phil. I says, you can't, we're not going to be able to run the feature that way. He says, oh, no. He says, that'll be okay. Well, I couldn't, you know, it went over center so hard. Phil won the feature from the back that night.
How many cars did he beat, do you think?
was probably 16 or 18 cars. Mm. That was kind of an average field.
To paint the picture, what does an A-class car look like at this point?
Generally, was a cut-down body car. You know, that even if it was like a, and it could be lower, you know, like, but the old square top cars were kind of going out, you know, the, like the 32 Ford bodies and stuff.
Oh, coupes. Okay.
Coupes. It was still in the coupes.
Yeah. Yeah. What was the difference between an A-class and a B-class?
The A-class, they could run a 302 V8 engine in them. And the B-class, you know, was a modified bomber engine with 250 cubic inch limit, but.
And then the C-class was kind of a run what you brung?
It started off as more like a street stock, but do you know how that went?
Oh, I do. I witnessed the Wildcats.
Yes. It didn't take long from the C-class, you know, and then when it became the limited sportsman, you know, it was a pretty good race car.
So when Phil Libby wins that race that night, despite all the problems, you know, crashing the car and everything in the qualifying race, do you remember that victory lane? Do you remember anything about that night?
Well, what I remember most about Phil, I think, I don't know that particular night, but that was also the year that Phil was driving the Pure Hell Camaro in the B class. Him and Homer was just week after week. I mean, that was a race to watch. You know, Homer was in Jerry Seavey's 22 coupe and Phil had that Camaro. Sometimes it spilled over. If it was the last race of the night, you know, and things hadn't gone well, there were some people one night that was going to come down and beat Phil up, and somebody threw a punch inside the car, and Phil was still strapped in and stuff. So we just had to kind of shoo them away. But it really didn't go beyond that. But that was an exciting year.
Yeah. Did Homer Drew ever drive for you?
He didn't. No, he didn't. He was, you know, always Bob Bushley's guy and Jerry Seavey's guy. And, yeah, what a talent. He could drive. Phil and him could drive anything. You know, Ralph wanted things just right. You know, I preferred things just right, a different style.
Was there someone that you wished drove the 61?
Well, of course, I would have loved to have had Mike Rowe. Mike and I grew up in Auburn together. We've known each other since we were both kids and stuff. You know, and he got together with Butch Craig, and Butch Craig actually worked for me at my garage for a while before he went to Matthews Machinery there working on forklifts, and then he started his own business. But Mike would have been, but I used to borrow Mike every once in a while, you know, he'd run a show here or there for me, but it probably would have been Mike.
Tell me about when the Super Modifieds came around.
The 1974 was the start of the Super Modifieds, and you know, I promised, you know, Ralph and I talked, and if I got a new car. So I was looking through Gator Racing News, and I saw this ad, a big picture on the front of it, that tube frames had been allowed in New York State, okay? So I called Show Car Engineering, a guy named Howard Conkey. He was big into the Supers at Oswego and stuff, and the Dirt Modifieds, and talked to him, told him what the track was here and stuff. And he said, well, I think I got a car that would work for you. And the start of the Super Modifieds, you know, was a mix of sprint cars. I think, like Dick Bergwin, I think would have preferred to have it all sprint cars, but the Supers were mixed in. And it was really good because the sprint cars went better when the track was in a certain condition and the Supers had a little advantage other times. But I really, and Ralph, wanted a safe car. You know, I mean, I love the sprint cars, but, you know, there's not a lot of protection in those cars.
How radical were the Super Modifieds at the time?
That first year, like the car that I bought from out in New York, brand new, they built the frame, the cage, and it had inboard mounted coilovers on the front. It had Kony shocks on the front. And we finished the rest of it off. But I started the season with a LT1 350 Chevy in it.
How much money you have in these cars or that particular car?
I would say, you know, you could buy a brand new LT1 for probably about $1,200. And the car, I probably paid them about $2,500 for the chassis, and we finished it ourselves with a homemade body. We actually took a old Vega car and narrowed up the back end of a Vega, so people thought it had a Corvette rear end on it, Corvette looking, and then the rest of the doors were just sheet metal and stuff.
Where do you get these ideas?
There was a guy that worked for me in the garage, Bill York, that thought up the idea about putting that body onto
that
the back of it.
Yeah. Wow.
And he did make that body and put it on.
Why did they bring the super modifieds around to Beechridge?
I think Dick Bergen wanted to race there, and he liked the sprint cars, and he was a big influence there, you know what I mean? And he was really good for the racetrack over the years, you know, all the articles that got into national magazines and papers that never would have happened if he hadn't have raced there.
What was his claim to fame aside from driving?
You know, he promoted the original Spring Sizzler.
Right.
You know.
Did he have Stock Car Racing Magazine at that point?
He had Stock Car Racing Magazine. And he actually had a 3-month series about winning a championship. He wanted to win a championship at Beechridge so bad, you know, and he wrote up all about it. I've got all 3 magazines.
You know, so Ralph and you team up with this particular race car, and you guys do pretty well. I mean, were you nervous seeing a car going that fast around the racetrack?
Not with him, really. It was Ralph seldom ever wrecked anything, including drive lines or anything else. I mean, he was just easy on everything. But like I say, we won the opening day in 74 with that, and then we raced it for a few weeks that way, and then Ralph says, you know, it really doesn't have enough power, so.
Do you really need power at Beechridge, even in a super?
Do you know, Ralph had a special way of going around there, and I never knew exactly what he was doing for the longest time, but, you know, most of the time he was like in the top 3 in points, so he had to come from the back because they did a total invert then. I'd see him stick the car out about a half a lane, and he kind of dust that high lane off, you know, with any marbles that was up there. Yeah, 1 and 2 in particular, because it had a little more of an angle to the track way up to the top. And if you gave him that all by himself, he'd kind of float the car into 1, because everybody back then drove the car in just as hard as they could on the bottom into 1, you know. Mm. And so, and then we worked on the car for weeks to get it so he could stick it right back on the floor on the top of that coming off, and he'd take long runs off the corner. So he'd be up beside, while they're back down in the bottom lane running into each other, he's up there, you know, passing 2 or 3 cars.
It's like a really fast powder puff car.
Yeah.
You know, because everybody would go ramming around down on the inside while your driver just slides around on the outside.
Yeah, and you know, later on, I got after him about that because he'd get to the front and he'd get out front and then he'd stay up top and, like, say Homer or whoever would be driving underneath him on the bottom going into the turn because they drove in so hard, and then he'd pull back away from them on the top.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I says, geez, Ralph, you're scaring me to death. We're gonna lose one pretty soon doing that, staying up there. He says, okay. The next week, he gets to the front, yeah, right, with about 2 to go. He pulls down in the bottom. He hadn't been down there all night. And there's this gigantic hole going into 3, and the car bottomed out. Time he got going again, we was like in 8th place.
Wow.
he says, well, you want me to do that again? And he says, no, I'll pass. I'll let you drive. Don't ever listen to me again.
You know, Dave, of course, has won a ton of races, but you have to get to the racetrack in order to win those races. And Dave had a very interesting race hauler, an old school bus, emphasis on the word old.
So one night we're coming down, I was living in Green at the time. We get down into Lewiston, going across the bridge there into Auburn. I lost the brakes.
Ooh. And for those that don't know the lay of the land, that's pretty steep hill.
And so I got this handbrake down on the floor, and I'm gearing the thing down, right? And I got it stopped, you know, before I got all around to Center Street. He says, what the heck are we going to do? Get the hammer out. Rolled underneath it. It was a rusted brake line. We hammered the thing shut. And he says, we can't be late to the races. My wife says, why? We're still going to the races? You don't have any brakes.
You don't have any brakes.
I says, I got a handbrake over here, and I can pump the brakes up now, I think, a little bit. I couldn't. It never did help anyway.
Wait a minute. You went from Lewiston to Scarborough on the highway?
Yeah.
No brakes?
No brakes. Right down the main turnpike.
That is next time on Open Trailer Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Austin. Talk to you next time.